Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California, and on the World Wide Web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and business of writing. Today my guest is literary agent Vicky Bourgeur, who has been in publishing for more than 20 years. She worked at Oxford University Press from 76 until 85 and has been an agent since 1986. After 2 years with a respectable Charlotte Sheedy literary agency, she started her own agency in 1988. She represents both fiction and nonfiction. Most of the fiction she handles is in the mystery genre, and her clients include three winners of the Edgar Allan Poe Award. The nonfiction includes biography, history, and travel, as well as books about food, theater, women's issues, childcare, the environment, and health, both mental and otherwise. Vicky is immediate past president of the Association of Authors Representatives, the only American organization of literary agents. For 2 years, she taught a course on the role of the literary agent at NYU School of Continuing Education, and appears frequently on panels on publishing. Are you there, Vicky? Are you there? I think we must have lost her. So what I'm going to do is play another song and don't go away.
More than glad to be on.
Okay, I think we have her back. Let me see. Are you there, Vicky?
I'm here.
Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Where is she?
Hello?
Thank you. Are you there?
I'm here.
Thank you. I'm okay. So happy, too, that I have you on the line. Anyway, I just introduced you and gave your wonderful bio. And now that you're on Writers on Writing, tell me, what sort of material excites you?
I love a freshness of tone in fiction, something that makes me feel, gee, I haven't read this before, or I see hundreds if not thousands of queries, and sometimes I begin to feel I've seen this so many times before. So what I look for in fiction is a freshness of tone, a surprising quality. It's good writing, obviously, but it's fresh. It doesn't feel like I've seen it before. And nonfiction has to be very solid. It has to convince me. It has to be plausible. One of the things an agent does when she's considering a new project is she puts herself in the prospective editor's chair. And I think part of an agent's job is to think of all the questions that an editor might ask about a project, and what you want to do as an agent is try and forestall those questions. That is, you think of all the questions and then you try and get the proposal for the nonfiction book to answer them before they're even raised.
Mm-hmm. So, with fiction then, whether it's literary or, say, genre fiction, is tone, is voice as important in both of those areas? Is it more important in literary fiction? Are you looking for something a little different in different types of fiction?
Well, with mysteries, there are a variety of things you're looking for, aside from very good writing and a freshness of tone. The sleuthing has to be plausible. There can't be coincidences. I always say there are three kinds of mysteries. There's the private eye, there's the amateur sleuth, and there's the police procedural, and the amateur sleuth mystery is really the hardest to write because the average Joe citizen has to have a really convincing reason for investigating a homicide on his or her own. And curiosity is never enough. So there's a little more of a formula in terms of what I look for in a mystery, but I'm very picky about the mysteries I take on, and I just have to feel the writing is really wonderful.
What percentage of fiction is what you take in? How do you divide it down, the nonfiction and fiction that comes in?
I'd say it's probably 50-50.
Really?
And I represent quite a few mystery writers, and they generally write about a book a year or a book every 15 or 18 months. And then the fiction writers, you know, if you have a doctor doing a book or a specialist in a field doing a book, generally that person has perhaps only one book in him or her. But then I represent also a number of writers who are professional writers, and, you know, they are producing a book every few years. But I would say it's about 50-50.
Do you prefer one over the other?
No.
No.
I love both.
Hmm. Now, does the way a writer approach you figure into whether you decide to represent them? Could somebody send you a perfectly good, say, query or proposal, and they were obnoxious in some way? They either called you too much, or they just did something that just grated against your nerves, and you decided on that to not represent them, or is it really very much just the writing?
No, I think the relationship, I'm sure this has been said many times before on your show, the relationship between an agent and her client is like a marriage. So the chemistry, I think, has to be right. And if I'm very excited about a project, I'll do everything I can to get along with the writer. There are certain red flags that agents, you know, have come to recognize in clients or prospective clients. I don't know that I've ever had the experience of being really excited about a project and then deciding, gee, this is someone I really, really don't want to work with. But it may be that what excites me about a project is so much a reflection of the writer that if I like the project, chances are I'm going to be able to get along with the writer.
Mm-hmm. So what is the best way for a writer to contact you?
A query letter with a stamped, self-addressed envelope. I never respond to queries that are emailed to me or faxed to me. Occasionally people call, and I've reached the point where I say to them, please put this in a query letter.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just at a writer's conference meeting with dozens and dozens of writers, and I told each one of them, it doesn't matter how good your project is, if your query letter isn't good, nobody's ever going to get past that to look at the project. And a lot of these writers said to me, oh, a query letter is so much harder to write than the manuscript itself, and that's true. But it's a very important tool in finding an agent.
This is 88.9 FM. My guest is New York literary agent Vicki Rougeour. Now, I can see how a query letter could let you know exactly what the project is if it's a nonfiction project, but how does a query letter that is written in a businesslike manner
mm-hmm.
get across the quality of fiction when the tone of the fiction, the style, is probably way different than the writer's query letter?
I think in a query letter from a fiction writer, I'm not looking for tone or style in the query letter. I'm just looking for someone who doesn't say to me, I've written a fictional novel, for example. I'm not kidding. I mean, I've probably gotten hundreds of query letters that say I've written a fictional novel.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes what writers do is they send a query letter with a synopsis alone, and I always say a synopsis on its own is useless because of what you say. It has nothing to do with the writing itself. So if a writer wants to send material in addition to the query letter, I think it's a good idea to send the first chapter or two of the book so that the agent can get a sense of the tone and the style.
Along with the query letter.
Along with the query
mm-hmm.
letter. And sometimes writers make the mistake of sending chapter 15 or 17 because they think that's their strongest chapter, but that's useless from an agent's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Because if chapter 1, if the first few pages of chapter 1 don't draw you in, then it doesn't matter how good chapter 15 is.
Yes. Now, just this morning, actually, a literary agent friend of mine emailed me with a quote from, I guess, a recent issue of The Nation, in which the publishing industry, it just sounded like publishing as we know it is going away and is going to be replaced by e-books and all sorts of electronic publishing. It was very disheartening. And what do you think about all that? Do you believe it? Has publishing changed gobs since you started agenting in the 80s?
Yes, there are many fewer houses. There are many more houses under the umbrella of this or that conglomerate. It means it's harder to, get a really good competition going among houses because, for example, all the houses that are now part of Random House, say, won't bid against each other in an auction. And until, 2 years ago, Bantam, Doubleday, Dell were separate from Random House, Pantheon, Knopf, Villard, etc. So that's changed. Yes, I think publishing is changing radically. Publishing is always in a state of change, but I think the velocity has changed. I think things are changing faster and faster. As for ebook publishing, I think there's a race going on to see whether the upstart ebook publishers are going to take over, or whether the current traditional publishers will co-opt that process. That is, in the past few months, one by one, I think most of the major houses have announced ebook divisions. Time Warner has its, and Random House has made an announcement and started publishing, et cetera. And I think the publishing houses realize they have to get into this business very fast, or else it will be, it will be taken over by all these new houses that are popping up. Of course, some of the new houses that are popping up 6 months after they open their doors for business are changing direction radically.
So if a writer sends you a query letter and says, I just had a book published on iUniverse, how does that affect you? Does it make you feel like you want to see their work, or do you say, okay, and what else?
Oh, well, I've never had that happen. Second of all, I mean, I've done deals with iUniverse for my clients' backlist books. I'm not sure that information alone wouldn't have any influence one way or another. If someone said, I've had a book published by iUniverse, and through the Barnes & Noble website, it sold X thousands or X hundreds of thousands of copies, then I would really sit up and take notice. That would sort of be analogous to what happens if you get a letter saying, I've been published by a tiny independent press in Colorado or Ohio, and they've sold 20,000 copies. Then in New York, everyone sits up and takes notice.
Yes. The numbers.
Yes.
What about if a writer or fiction writer is querying you and says, I've been published in Zoetrope and various other respectable literary magazines? Does that help sway you?
Huge help. This may sound terribly unfair. What an agent isn't so interested in is a letter that says, I've just retired after 45 years as a biology teacher or a post office worker, or I've been in the Army, and I've always thought I wanted to write, and now I finally can. That is, what you want is someone who's been sending stuff out there for years and trying and really working at it, and having been published in Zoetrope or, any literary journal, or Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, is a sign to an agent that this person is serious.
So people really write to you and give you their bios in that way?
Oh, yes. Hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Interesting. What about short story collections? Do you represent short story writers, and are they easier to sell? Well, I would think they're easier to sell if the writer has had previous publications.
I'm not sure I've ever sold a short story collection. I've seen some. I recently saw one that was absolutely fabulous, and the writer had her short stories published individually in literary journals, and that's the way to go. That's how you get a short story collection published by a publisher, is to have these stories published previously.
And, of course, that could take years to get short stories published in journals. It can be a lengthy process.
Yes. I think as hard as it is to get a novel published, it's probably easier to get a novel published than a collection of short stories, especially if the stories have never been published anywhere.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. My guest is literary agent Vicky Bergeron. In terms of fiction, is there a certain area of fiction that's easiest to sell?
I don't handle romances, and I'm not sure if it's easy to sell, but I know romances do very, very well. It seems no matter what's going on in the marketplace, romances seem to sell.
I heard actually romances were the most, in terms of area of fiction, that romances oversold all others.
Yes.
Now, and that, I told a student of mine that the other night, and he said, but you go in the bookstore, and they're on one shelf. And I went, interesting.
Well, that's an interesting point. It may be that the really successful romance writers are selling out of supermarkets, drugstores,
yes,
airports. I heard an interesting statistic, or maybe it was a factoid a few years ago, that the majority of paperback book sales take place outside bookstores.
Hmm.
They take place in Kmart and supermarkets and price clubs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's a lot that's going on that I think most people don't think of when it comes to publishing and selling their work. What about the memoir? We hear contrasting reports that the memoir is dead, the memoir will never be dead, sort of like we hear about the novel. The novel is dead.
The novel's not dead, I don't think, and memoir goes on and on and on. I mean, it seems to be a very healthy genre.
Hmm.
And Mary Carr, who, as you know, who seemed to have started the recent Vogue, has just published her second. I think you could call Angela's Ashes a memoir, and that's broken all kinds of records. So it seems to be a very healthy genre.
Would you say the memoir, the form of the memoir, is closest to fiction in that the writing matters, the writer's style matters more than, say, another type of nonfiction book?
Yes. I mean, you know, there is... what's been called literary nonfiction, narrative nonfiction that's beautifully written, but yes, the literary style matters a great deal in the memoir, certainly more than it would in a nonfiction book like a health book or how-to or self-help or that relationships, that kind of thing.
Yeah. In terms of nonfiction, how important is the nonfiction author's background and experience? Are you looking for people who have some sort of following? Is it enough to have a good idea?
No, I'm afraid it's never enough to have a good idea. I tell everybody all the time, publishing these days is completely market-driven, and it's not enough to have a good idea. And in nonfiction, it's not even enough, to be simply well-written. When I first became an agent in the late 80s, I could sell, and I did sell, books on medical topics or medical-related issues, health topics, by journalists. And after about 5 or 6 years, I realized that the publishers were only looking at books by MDs or perhaps PhDs. The credential became more and more important. So that when I take on a health book these days, there has to be a doctor attached or a major medical institution or somebody with a PhD. And then there are other sorts of books, self-help, relationship books, where it's an enormous help if the author already has a forum, if he has a column, a radio show, a national reputation. That's true, I think, for cookbooks. You know, if the chef has a television show, it's going to be much, much easier to sell his or her book.
Mm-hmm. How many times might you send a manuscript or a proposal to an editor or to a number of editors before you decide it's not going to sell? Does it depend upon the project, or do you just have in your mind a set figure that if I send it out a dozen times and nothing happens, that's it?
No, I'm not sure I've ever said that. I sold a project about a year ago that I'd been trying to sell for 3 years, and I had first sent it out as a proposal, and then I sent it out when I had a partial, and finally, and nobody bit, and finally when I had the whole manuscript. It was a book that had been commissioned by a European publisher, so the author was writing it anyway. When I had a whole manuscript, I sold it on the basis of the whole manuscript, and I just kept trying and trying and trying. On the other hand, if, for example, there's a novel, and I send it out, and I send it out, and after about 20 attempts, I realize I'm hearing the same thing over and over and over and over again, then I say to the author, well, I wouldn't wait for 20 in that case, but if I hear the same thing over and over, I would say to the author at a certain point, let's talk about this. And let's consider revising it, because you can't send it, unless an editor specifically asks, you can't send it back to the same editor
mm-hmm.
after it's been revised.
Interesting. Well, we're going to take a short break, and I hope you stay with us and come back in just a couple of minutes.
Okay.
I'll allow you and everyone else to get up and stretch, unless you're driving, in which case, please don't. Just keep your eyes on the road. Don't turn the dial or push the button. We'll be right back with Vicki Bajor. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California, and at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is Vicki Bajor. She's a literary agent in New York. Vicki.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Are you a per-project agent, or do you like to represent an author over time through different projects?
The latter. I have many clients whom I've had for years and years and years, since the late 80s. That's what I prefer. I'm much more interested in a writer's whole career than in just doing one book. I certainly have clients, you know, who just have done one book, but I find it deeply satisfying to work with writers over the course of their career.
Mm-hmm. So, say a writer sends you a query for, let's say, a nonfiction proposal. What happens then? Say you like the idea, you ask to see a book proposal?
Yes. I ask to see a book proposal, and if they don't have the book proposal, I tell them the book proposal has to answer certain questions. It has to cover marketing. It has to explain why the writer is the perfect person to write such a book. Most important, it has to discuss the competition, what other books are available on that topic or on related topics, and how his or her book is different, and why there's still a niche in the marketplace for another book. And the proposal has to include a chapter-by-chapter outline with several paragraphs to a page on the contents of each chapter. Mm. And I have to be convinced there's a there's really a book there, that it's not a magazine article, it's not an idea, you know, that came to him at 3 in the morning.
is there a most important part of a book proposal?
I wouldn't say there's a most important part. I think all the parts have to be strong. I think editors love to see that the author's thinking in terms of the market. That is, if the author's familiar with how many people this book might reach, or how to reach those people, how to find the right mailing list or the right association that would, cater to this group. Or if it's a book of narrative nonfiction, for example, that someone might buy, you know, for reading pleasure as opposed to for the information, it's always helpful to compare it to some other successful book in that field. You know, this is for the readers of The Perfect Storm, or this is for the people who love Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Are there areas that are oversaturated, and even if you like an idea or a proposal very much, you might not take it on because you feel it's just right now that market is saturated?
Yes. I think there are certain areas of, for example, women's health. I don't think, I've sold several books on breast cancer, for example. I think that's a very hard area. It's very saturated at the moment. So yes, there can't be. It's a tough line. There can't be too many books, and yet I've had editors say to me, "Well, there's never been a book on that subject, so obviously there's no interest in it." I once heard a wonderful magazine editor say that every idea was like a wave, and you had to hit the wave at the right moment.
So something that doesn't sell today might sell next year.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So earlier when you were talking about sending out a particular project for, I think you said, 3 years,
mm-hmm.
I began wondering about the instinctual side of agenting and how much of agenting is instinctual. How much of it is you feel something about a project, you just feel it, and as long as you feel that, you'll stay with it?
Absolutely. I think a lot of it's instinctual. You asked earlier how important is it that the agent feel comfortable with the author. If in a case where a book doesn't sell, I think the client's relationship with the agent is crucial for the agent to say, I believe in this person, and I really want this person's work to sell. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I'm curious then, the client then would have to very much trust the agent, and if this is all new to you as a writer, you now have an agent who has sent your work out however many times and now says either they can't sell it, or perhaps a year has gone by, 2 years has gone by, and nothing has happened. How does a writer know whether the agent they have or that they're considering is aggressive enough, and how do they know if it's just a project that just isn't going to fly?
Well, for one thing, I always send my clients copies of the rejection letters so that a client can see which editors have received the project and what they've had to say in response to it. I think a client has to trust his agent's judgment, and if he doesn't, then he should find a new agent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a client has to have the kind of relationship with an agent in which if an agent says, I believed in this project, but we've gotten so many responses raising the issue of X, Y, or Z, let's talk about it, you know, then in a good author-client, author-agent relationship, the author's open to really rethinking the project.
Sure. Well, you mentioned if you're not happy with your agent, then perhaps the only alternative is to fire them. But how do you feel about authors who have left an agent and now want you?
Well, I think that happens all the time, and it perhaps even happens with increasing frequency. I had that happen recently with someone who had a novel, and they could not get any idea from the agent of where this novel had been sent. They hadn't seen the letters. They had only a vague idea. So it's not always a sign that of the author's failure by any means.
Yes. And authors are so prone to interpreting every little bit of rejection or hesitation as their failure, which I don't know if this is true of others in other creative arts, but writers tend to be especially depressive, I think.
Certainly sensitive.
Yes, certainly sensitive. This is 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is New York literary agent Vicki Bergeron. I also notice about agents that good agents know how to say no. Now,
to clients,
to projects. They just,
yes.
What I should have said is agents very much know their own mind and aren't afraid of speaking it.
Right.
Do you find that?
Oh, absolutely. Because agents don't get paid until they sell something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a book publicist, for example, a freelance book publicist gets thousands and thousands of dollars, a lot of it up front. And that publicist might never get you on Oprah or get your book reviewed in People or get you interviewed in, you know, your hometown paper. And that publicist still gets paid. You know, if you have a lawyer who gets a retainer, the lawyer keeps that money, whether or not he loses your case. But an agent doesn't get paid unless she sells your book.
Mm-hmm.
So agents have to really guard their time and value it. So an agent has to be able to say, I can't sell this, or I'm not the right agent for this, or in my experience, this is going to be a hard project to make a go of. Agents also say, you know, I among them say, this is good, but it's just not to my taste. I'm not the right person for this.
I would think that's one of the hardest things about being an agent, is having to be just that blunt and that straightforward.
Well,
or maybe it's just a certain personality type. I think I would find it hard to say no.
I never ever say this is unpublishable. Never. That's my fact.
That's okay.
I only say I'm not the right agent for this.
Mm-hmm.
I think there may be agents out there who say this is no good or you'll never find a publisher, and quite often they're proven wrong.
Yes.
Because it, especially with fiction, taste is completely subjective. So I don't think of it as having to be brutally blunt. I only think of it as having to figure out what I'm best at and whether I would be a good match with that material or that client.
Well, you said just a few minutes ago that an agent only makes money when they sell something. What about all the fee-charging agents? Now, there's a resource book. Half of it, I believe, is half the listings in it are fee-charging agents.
What book?
I guess the Writer's Digest book of literary agents. There's the front part, which is comprised of non-fee-charging agents, and then following that are fee-charging agents. There's quite a few of these people. And I would imagine that somebody is sending their work there and paying anywhere from a couple hundred dollars to whatever for a reading and for perhaps a critique.
Well, I have very strong feelings about that. I don't charge reading fees. I belong to an agent's organization, the AAR, the Association of Authors Representatives, and we are not allowed to charge reading fees, none of our members. I think there may be reputable agents who charge reading fees, but that it's something that's so open to abuse that you're better off finding an agent who doesn't charge reading fees.
Yes. So AAR, again, one of the qualities of an agent who joins that organization is no reading fees.
Right.
What are some of the other things that, if a person is looking at an agent who's a member of AAR, that they can feel, assured of?
Well, in order to join, you have to have been an agent full-time for 2 years, and you have to have letters of reference from two other members, and you have to have sold 10 books within the last 18 months before you apply for membership.
Mm-hmm.
There's an AAR website that has a wonderful list of questions that a writer should ask a prospective agent and that a reputable agent will be happy to answer. And if you'd like the AAR website address,
sure.
It's right here on my Rolodex. It's www.aar-online.org.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it lists agents and all sorts of things.
Yes, it includes the AAR Canon of Ethics, which all of its members follow, and it has a list of these very good trenchant questions that you should ask a prospective agent.
Why would an agent not belong to AAR? I know a few agents that don't, and they seem to say, I just never got around to it. I probably should. I've never heard any complaints about these people and all that, but why do you think?
Why wouldn't someone join?
Yeah.
Well, I think there are many, many wonderful agents outside of New York City, and lots of wonderful agents in California. But I think if you're not in New York, you may feel, well, the AAR has monthly meetings for its membership in New York, and if I'm not there, I won't be able to take advantage of those. So that may be one reason.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are just not joiners. There are wonderful, wonderful agents who don't belong, but if it does provide, a certain level of guarantees about the caliber of your agent's work.
Mm-hmm. In terms of interviewing an agent, say you've gotten to a point with an agent where someone's offering to represent you, what are very important questions to ask? Is there something that you should just always know about your agent, your prospective agent, or should it be more of an instinctual thing, a feeling of trust?
Well, there should be some instinctual feeling of trust, certainly, and there should be some sense that whatever correspondence or communication you've had has been comfortable. I don't think there's any one question or any one thing that you must know. I think, of course, it always helps if that agent's been referred by somebody you know, or if you know other clients whom the agent represents. I think many of the new clients I take on, know me by reputation, so they're, mm-hmm. They don't ask me questions like, well, what have you sold? I mean, I don't know how I would take to it if someone said, what have you sold recently, or, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of the people I take on have a general sense of the kind of thing I do.
Would you say that most of the people, the authors that come to you through referral? Or do they find you in a resource book?
All different ways. Lots by referral. Or they find my name in the acknowledgments of books they've liked. Agents always love it when they get query letters, and we all get hundreds of query letters. If the query letter starts by saying, I know you represent X, Y, and Z, and I'm a huge fan of those clients, and I hope very much you'll want to take a look at my work. Agents are very flattered by that, and it also shows that the writer has done his or her homework
mm-hmm.
in researching agents.
Yes.
I mean, I get lots of queries from people who've written romances or horror novels or science fiction, and I just don't do those.
Mm-hmm. So you have to wonder why they're even sending
right.
you material.
Right.
Yeah. This is 88.9 FM. My guest is New York literary agent Vicki Bourgeois. How many queries do you receive a week?
You know, probably varies from week to week. It may be 3 or 4 or 5 a day. So that's, you know, 20 a week or so.
Do you like it when writers tell you this is a simultaneous submission, or do you assume that it is?
With a query letter, I assume it is. Even if it's a query letter with 2 or 3 chapters, I assume it is. If I then ask to see the whole manuscript, that's the point at which I say, has anyone else asked to see this? Or that's the point at which the author will say, I hope, you're the third agent who's asked to see this. I just want you to know that. And do you want to read it on an exclusive submission? Because if so, you know, then we have to wait for Agent Z to finish it, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But I assume the initial query is multiple.
So then if you request to see the entire manuscript or, I suppose, book proposal, would you demand an exclusive, or is that just sort of common knowledge that this is what happens?
I don't think it's common knowledge. I think you have to discuss it with the writer and work it out.
Do you like it when clients suggest editors and publishing houses to try? Or do you prefer for the writer to just sort of stay out of it and just let you do your job?
I don't mind it at all. And often, you know, often they have very good ideas about what might be an appropriate place. That's not to say I wouldn't have thought of the same thing, but I certainly don't mind it. And I work very closely with my clients. That is, I generally tell them I've called the following list of editors, or I'm going to be approaching the following houses. That's the sort of thing I would discuss initially, and I would also discuss, you know, whether I see this as a paperback original, a mass market paperback original, trade paperback original, whether I would insist on hardcover, initial publication and hardcover. I'd discuss all that.
Mm-hmm. Can you say what average advances are for, say, nonfiction by a new writer or fiction by a new writer? Is there an average?
Really hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you read about first novels going for vast sums of money, and then their first novels going for, you know, 4 figures.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't think there's an average. I mean, you know, maybe Publishers Weekly has done some study and come up with the average, but I'm not familiar with it.
And does that hold true for nonfiction as well?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It depends very, especially with nonfiction, depends very much on the topic, the author, the credentials, the market.
Interesting. Yeah, I know of recent writers who have gotten very high advances for fiction and very low, and you just have to wonder if one is seen as perhaps a blockbuster, whereas the other is seen as a small book.
Well, I would say so, but there are blockbusters that fail miserably, and often it's a career killer.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of one writer who was published with huge fanfare, and the sales did not live up to the publisher's expectations by any means, and I've heard of two book deals in which the second book was dropped or the second book was published in a much smaller way and the author never earned back the advance and no one else would touch him.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are lots and lots of writers out there reinventing themselves under pseudonyms.
What do they do then when it's time to hand in a picture for the book flap?
That's a good question.
Airbrushing.
I think they just don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
There are men writing as women and women writing as men and all kinds of ways to reinvent yourself.
I always wonder that when I pick up a book and there's no picture. I always sit there and go, well, now why isn't there a picture here? You know,
well,
I want to see the picture.
But you wouldn't not buy a book because there's
no
picture. No,
definitely not.
Right.
One of my favorite books has no picture.
Right.
Anyway, we're at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any little tidbit, any pearl you'd like to put forth.
I once heard a writer who had been trying and trying. She wasn't a client of mine. She'd been trying and trying and trying for years and years to get published, and she finally sold her book. And she said her advice to other writers was never give up, never give up, never give up.
Hmm.
And I was really inspired by her.
Yes. Yes, that is inspiring. It can be a discouraging business, and we need writers like that who,
yes,
and people like you who remind us that all is not lost.
Well, thank you.
Vicki, I thank you so much for being on the show. If people want to find you, they can find you in Literary Marketplace.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Vicki Brejeur in New York. If you have comments or questions, please email me at writersonwriting@aol.com or visit my website at writersonwriting.com. I'd like to read a short piece to you called In the Midst of Things. Before you know it, it is already the day before Memorial Day. It is twilight, and your husband is blending margaritas, and your child is begging you to come outside and play baseball. Jazz plays on the radio. Your husband turns from the blender, does a little dance. You can hear your son outside now, playing with his Fisher-Price workbench, all plastic. Your husband pours the margaritas, and he looks at you, and he smiles, and your son smiles because you and your husband love each other, and he knows this and takes comfort in it. You wish there were some device, some invention, scratch-and-sniff cards, perhaps, on which you could capture your life as it is right now. So you hurry to your laptop that you let run on the off chance inspiration will hit, and you type fast, getting down what is on your mind before your husband makes you take that margarita with salt along the rim of the glass, his outstretched frozen fingers waiting. And then he asks you what you are doing, and you smile and say something brief and satisfactory. All of life is material when you're a writer. Right in the middle of living, you'll find yourself reaching for paper or your computer, wanting to record what you're going through before it's over, and you forget. Writers understand this need, understand how ephemeral thoughts and images work. So reach, write, explain. Your words are better than a camera, because the words you put down now will help you to remember what it was like so long ago, when all was good and your child was young, and the day was warm and happy. This is 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine, California. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and thank you for listening.